Ahuneo, Dakineo, Anjali Karaneo, Anuttaram Punya Ketan Lokasa, Tamaham Sangham Abhipujayami, Tamaham Sangham Sirasa Namami.
Namo tassa
bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa.
Iti piso
bhagava arahaṃ sammāsambuddho vicchācharana sampanno sugato lokavidu anuttaro purisa dhammasārati sattadera manussānaṃ Buddho Bhagava Tamaham Bhagavantam Abhipujayami Tamaham Bhagavantam Sirasa Namami
Suakato
Bhagavata Dhammo Sanditiko akariko egipasiko Opanayiko pachatam vedita bolin yuhi Tamaham dhammam abhipujayami Tamaham dhammam sirasa namami
Supatipanno
Bhagavato Savakasangho Ujjupatipanno Bhagavato Savakasangho Nyayapatipanno Bhagavato Savakasangho Samichipatipanno Bhagavato Savakasangho Yadidam Chattari Purisa Yugani Atta Purisa Pungala Esa Bhagavato Savakasangho Ahuneyo Ahuneyo Dakineyo Anjali Karaneyo Anuttaram Punya Ketan Lokasa Tamaham Sangham Abhipujayami Tamaham Sangham Sirasa Namami
Namo tassa
bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa.
Iti piso
bhagava arahaṃ sammāsambuddhassa.
John, we had a dependent origination guided meditation. Do you know what that is?
Oh, I'll leave that one. I'm not sure.
That's what? Too complicated.
Yes. See?
Complicated meditation.
No, but Venerable Pasada broke it down for us. So before I hand it over to Ajahn Brahmali and Venerable Sunil, I was told that it's Deepavali or Diwali. So I'd like to wish all who are celebrating the festival happy Deepavali. So with that, I'll hand that over to the monks.
Yeah.
Oh, and that we will finish around 5:30. But if people feel there's a need to go, then just leave quietly. Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. So, is that on? Hello.
Hello.
I think the microphone isn't on, Jake. So, okay. Yeah.
Now we can say whatever we want.
We can.
Here.
We had a quick, short opportunity here. Okay. Welcome back, everyone. So, thank you very much, Venables, for doing the meditation. Yeah, that's marvelous. We can share out the work a little bit. That's great. And can we get the slides on, Venables? There might be slides there. The next sequence of slides.
Okay. Want to do these two questions first?
Get up to the first one, otherwise it's problematic. No, we'll do this afterwards. We'll do that when we have a break for questions.
Okay, good idea.
Yeah.
Here we go, and boom.
Yeah. Okay, so we are now going to look at the connection between the first factors of dependent origination. Yeah, finally getting down to what this really is about. So we are well prepared now, right? We've done all the groundwork, so now hopefully we can understand what this is about. Hopefully a bit more easily, because we have done some of the foundational work. And the idea is, when you repeat things a number of times, it becomes easier to understand what actually is happening, how this works out. We're going to look at the first two factors, a little bit also the third factor also comes into this. So we're going to have a look at ignorance, avidya, and how that conditions willed activities or willed acts or willed actions. So what is the connection between ignorance and willed actions? And try to make that quite clear what is going on. And as we do that, we're also going to see how then the reduction in ignorance and eventually how eliminating it completely leads to a change in the willed actions and eventually the complete ending of those willed actions. And then we're going to see how that those willed actions in turn influence consciousness, the conditioning from willed actions to consciousness. This is what we're going to look at. We have already looked at ignorance itself, how that is conditioned. And as we have seen, ignorance, the reason why we are ignorant, ultimately comes back to the fact that we don't have any connection to people who see things according to reality. The superior people, the sapurisa, we don't have that input. And that is ultimately why that avidya, that ignorance, perpetuates itself. Once you start hearing the right kind of teachings, then that sequence we saw before, it starts to happen almost automatically. And that is a conditioned sequence, one thing leading to another. And this is one of the things that you see in Buddhism, in the early suttas, in the EBTs, how everything is about conditionality, how everything depends on something else. Everything has this conditioned aspect to it. So conditionality is really one of the core aspects of Buddhist teaching is this idea of conditionality, one thing leading to another. And the reason why this is so important in Buddhism is precisely because Buddhism does not have an idea of something solid like a creator god or a self or a soul or anything like that. When you take out the idea of something solid, something that is always there, an inherent substance or whatever you want to call it, take that out, then the only thing remaining is conditionality, the things condition each other. Yeah. So we have seen how ignorance arises. Now we're going to have look in more detail about the connection between ignorance and willed actions, willed activities. This is the first three factors. Yeah. So we're going to see. Just have a very quick look at them. So you have the first two is ignorance leading to willed, avidya, paccaya, sankara, avidya leading to sankara, ignorance leading to willed actions. Yeah, what is a willed action? It's just basically any act that you use a will to do. It's almost anything, yeah, almost any activity, whether by speech, by bodily action, or by mind that you do. And then from that will, from that avidya, paccaya, sankara, avidya leading to sankara, then you have sankara, paccaya, vijnana. From the condition of sankara, there is vijnana, consciousness. Yeah? So willed acts, willed actions lead to consciousness. And it's a bit mysterious when you see it like that. Yeah, ignorance and willed actions, you may be getting a slight feeling now for what it means. But once you start to see this, you will see it is far less mysterious than actually it may seem. It's actually a fairly natural and a fairly straightforward way of understanding what is going on here. This morning, Venerable Sunyo pointed out a number of ways of understanding the idea of ignorance and avidya. And one of the main ones, the way it is defined in the suttas, is not understanding the Four Noble Truths. Yeah. And, of course, the Four Noble Truths, they revolve around the idea of dukkha, of suffering. Suffering is core aspect of what those Four Noble Truths are. Yeah? So because of that, one of the important ways I'm going to look at this connection is showing how ignorance about suffering leads to willed actions. Yeah, so ignorance about suffering is straight from the definition of the First Noble, definition of ignorance, yeah? Not understanding dukkha, yeah, dukkha, anjana, as it says there, or whatever, that leads to willed activities. But as we also showed this morning or before, is that not only is ignorance about not understanding dukkha, it's also about not understanding anicca, impermanence. Yeah, in fact, impermanence and dukkha very closely related to each other. Yeah. You see this everywhere in the word of the Buddha, the suttas, as always. You start with impermanence. And because things are impermanent, they're also dukkha. It's a very close relationship between the two. So I'm also going to show you why not understanding impermanence also leads to willed activities. Yeah? And then how this affects consciousness. And the last one, which we also had a look at this before, is anatta, non-self. Why not understanding non-self leads to willed activities. So these three things are called the three characteristics. They're the tilakana in Pali. And so these are very fundamental ways of talking about ignorance or knowledge in suttas. If you don't see these three characteristics clearly, you are by definition ignorant. That's one of the ways of understanding this term ignorance. And one of the reasons why I use these three is basically just because to me it's fairly easy to show the connection if you use these three characteristics. That's why I do it. So that's the reason. And that's a bit embarrassing, isn't it? Is it because it's easy? Or maybe I should really be using the Four Noble Truths. But it basically comes down to the same thing here. Okay. So to be able to grasp this, first of all, I'm going to talk very briefly about the meaning of the word willed action, sankara. This is often, people often ask about this. What does sankara actually mean? Something people are often very confused about. And so I'm going to start with this so that we can more easily show the connection between the two. So sankara, the meaning of sankara. And one of the things about sankara has two main meanings. And one is what you would call an active part. Yeah, and this is when we act from will, from volition, from intention, that is the active part of sankara. And that is the usual meaning. So if you think about the sankara is one of the five aspects of personality, yeah, known as the five khanda in Pali, five aspects of personality. One of those is sankhara. In there it means this. It is the active form, the willed activities that it means. Yeah. Dependent origination, again, it means this. It refers to the will, the active part, the willed activities, the doing of things. Yeah. This is what it means, independent origination. So active sankharas, will, yeah, activities. I like the idea of creation. Yeah, when you create things, we are trying to create a good life for ourselves. We're trying to create good relationships. We're trying to create a happy existence. And in doing all of this, we are actually creating a future for ourselves. So creation actually is not a bad translation for sankhara, although it kind of impinges a bit on Christianity and other religions. It is very similar to that idea. In one sense, we actually create the world through sankharas. We create our own world. Yeah, our own inner world comes about because of sankharas, because it leads to rebirth. It leads to how we experience the world around us and all of these kinds of things. Active sankharas. This is related to the word chaitana in Pali. Yeah, chaitana is one of the words you see in the suttas all the time. It means like intention. Yeah, intention. In other words, if you intend to do something, you tend to act on that. Yeah, intention. And this again is very closely related to kamma. Kamma actually means action. Yeah. So in Buddhism, the action that matters is intentional action. And that intentional action is exactly the same thing as willed activities, yeah? Creation. These are all the same thing. So kamma and sankhara are all virtually identical to each other. Someone asked that question before, and it was actually came more like a private message, and they asked, what's the connection between sankhara and kamma? And they are essentially the same thing. These are creative activities that lead to the kind of the carrying on of life, yeah, in the future, on and on and on. This is what we mean by sankhara, independent origination, this willed activity, yeah, actions driven by will inside. But it's useful to know that there is another meaning of the word sankhara, and it's the passive meaning of sankhara. And that is all the things that actually are created by the active sankhara. Yeah? So something that has been created, a conditioned phenomenon, this is what sankhara means in this context. So when we say, you know, famous Buddhist statements like sabbe sankhara anicca, all sankharas are impermanent, this is what we mean. Yeah? All sankharas there means all created things, all conditioned phenomena. That's what it means. So there it is much, it's a very broad thing. Yeah, it basically means everything. There is nothing really which isn't being created in that sense. So this is what we mean by sankhara in the passive sense. So the active sankharas are the will, and they create the passive sankharas, which are the outcome of that willing. Yeah? And that's why the same word is used. And it's very similar to how we use the word creation. Yeah. Creation in English can mean an act of creation. Yeah, an act of creation is when you actually make something. But creation can also mean like God's creation. When you say God's creation, you mean that which has been created by God. Both Him creating it and the fact that it has been created. Yeah, kind of Christian idea. So creation is a fairly close in meaning to the word sankhara. So let's be very... It has also more meanings than that, but they are bit subsidiary. Sometimes sankhara can be translated as a force, for example. A force, but a force is in some way similar to the idea of willed activities. It's a force that drives the world forward or something like that. But the main meaning that matters for dependent origination is the first one here, active, willed activities. Yeah. So that's just to define sankhara for you. So let's carry on. So a delusion, yeah, that the fact that we see the world in the wrong way leads to willed activities. It leads to creation. Exactly how does it do that? So when we are deluded about impermanence that leads to willed activities. Yeah, and the reason is because if you think things are more permanent than they actually are, they seem more attractive. If you really see things as impermanent, actually it's very unattractive because you're grasping for all this stuff that you must lose. Yeah, and often we lose it very quickly. But if you have the delusion that these things are relatively permanent, not necessarily absolutely permanent, but at least relatively permanent, they become more attractive. And so it's more natural that we pursue them as a consequence. You can see how that works, right? I'll come back to this in a second. You have delusion about suffering, also leads to willed activities. And again, this is the idea that we see things as far more satisfactory than they actually are. We think the outcome will be happiness, and we don't really see the outcome clearly of what we're doing. So this leads to activities. We try to appropriate or gain those things that will lead to happiness, not really understanding what is going on. Yeah? So delusion about suffering leads us to all of these things. Delusion about non-self. And this idea here is that if you feel that there is a self, it means you feel powerful. You feel that it is in your ability to create things. Yeah, one of the most important aspects of the sense of self is the ability to do. I am the agent in the world. I can make things happen. Yeah, and the more you understand that to be a delusion, then again, it kind of the idea of creating becomes nonsensical ultimately. Yeah. Oh, that was it. Okay, so let's start off by looking at the idea of impermanence and permanence. Yeah? So when we start out, when most people, ordinary people in the world who have no idea of the Buddhist teachings, there is this feeling that things in the world seem reasonably permanent. Certain things seem almost absolutely permanent, yeah? Like the sense of self may seem absolutely permanent. Yeah, you can see yourself, okay, I'm the same person from when I was a child. Yeah, the inner me is the same. There's all these things changing, but the inner me is the same. And that inner me is actually, to most people, seems permanent. But the things of the world, they often don't. If you ask somebody, they will recognize that they're not really permanent. Yeah, okay, you live in a house, it's not permanent. You are in a relationship, it's not permanent. We recognize that. But we don't recognize it very deeply. Things tend to seem far more permanent than they actually are. They seem reasonably permanent. And this is a big problem, yeah? Because that leads us to chase after those things. So our fantasies end with the fulfillment of our wishes. So when we fantasize about the future, and of course a very big part of our lives are craving, and because they are about craving, these are really fantasies about the future. You only fantasize, you only crave for something if you have an idea of what it is, and that is like a fantasy. Yeah. And usually when you fantasize about the future, usually that fantasy ends with the acquisition, attaining that fantasy. Yeah. You fantasize about relationship. Oh, how wonderful it would be to be in this relationship. Yeah. Oh, marvelous. Oh, this person is so wonderful. You don't know who they are, but still you think they're wonderful. And so you kind of, you know, you pursue that. What is interesting when you look at that delusion or that idea of, you know, getting into a relationship, then very often it stops. That fantasy stops at the point where you get into the relationship. Yeah. And it stops there. Yes, I got what I wanted. Yeah, this is it. And you don't go any further. You don't go beyond that. It stops at the fulfillment of that wish. Or if you have you are pursuing some nice thing in the world, like you want a new house, for example, yeah, or a new car or whatever it is, your fantasy about that house or car, it stops at the point where you acquire that house and the car. Yeah, now I got the house. You don't think beyond that. It stops at that point. So this is one of the problems with our fantasizing about the world. We stop at the point where our fantasy is fulfilled, and we don't go beyond that. And this is an important part of this delusion of permanence, yeah? Because if you stop at that point, what is beyond that, that's kind of taken care of, yeah? Because then you have reached your goal, but actually it isn't taken care of. It just seems that way, and that is part of this delusion that we're seeing here. All our fantasies are problematic. Yeah. So then because of that delusion, the idea that things are more permanent than they are, we chase after them because they seem attractive. Yeah, oh yeah, this relationship, yay, this relationship, wow, this person, so marvelous and wonderful. And then we kind of see ourselves together with this person, whoa, so great. And we don't go any further, and we're really happy. And then we chase after that person, yeah? This is the chasing after worldly things, chasing after that relationship, chasing after that house, chasing after that car, chasing after increase in social status, yeah? Chasing after promotion in your job, chasing after becoming more powerful in the monastery, right?
Yeah, power struggles in Bodhiana.
The famous power struggles of Bodhiana Monastery. It's not really a joke, because for a large, it doesn't really happen at Bodhiana Monastery, but it's a very common thing in the Buddhist world that people climb the hierarchy within the Buddhist world, yeah? So if you look at a lot of monasteries and a lot of Buddhist institutions around the world, they have hierarchies. And as soon as you have hierarchies, it means you have positions of power. Higher in the hierarchy means more power. And everybody wants power. Monks, nuns, everybody wants power. Yeah, this is just the way things are. Lay people, everyone. So once you have these hierarchies, you get this struggle for these things. So you, by creating these hierarchies, it's almost like you force, you know, the monastics too, to kind of get caught into this worldly trap, yeah, of climbing the ladder of hierarchies and social position and all these kind of things. So we chase after the things of the world, and that chasing, this is the willing, yeah, we act to get those things, all that willed activity that we do to get these things in the world that we think are more permanent than they actually are, that is the sankhara, yeah? So we run after things. What happens then? What happens then is that as part of this process, we make good and bad karma. Yeah, so when you chase after the things of the world, sometimes that chasing is positive. Yeah, you do it in a good way. You are kind of, you flatter the person you are interested in. Yeah, oh, you're so wonderful. Oh, darling, here are some flowers or whatever it is. Yeah, and then kind of you try to lure them into the you could make this work out somehow. Yeah, and then. And that is the kind of, you're making good karma because you're basically kind to the person. It's very easy to be kind when you're attracted to somebody. Yeah, it's not very hard. But sometimes you make bad karma. Sometimes there is a rival for that person. Yeah, this rival, they are destroying my happiness. Because they destroy my happiness, I must destroy them first. They have no right to destroy my happiness. Then you think of evil ways of getting rid of the rival. Yeah, this is so common in the world, right? Happens all the time. How can I get rid of this rival? And then you do things that are really naughty and bad karma to get rid of this rival. You know, this is just so common. And that is then the bad karma. So if someone stands in the way of your happiness, and this is what it seems like, a rival stands in the way of your happiness because your happiness depends on that relationship. It's not true, right? We know it's not true, but that's what you think at the time. My happiness, this person stands in the way of my happiness. Then you actually make bad karma too, so that you can actually get that happiness. What you don't understand, of course, is that you actually are creating suffering for yourself rather than creating happiness. You're doing the exact opposite of what you want to achieve. Instead of achieving happiness, you actually achieve suffering down the track. But you don't get that. Why? Because of delusion. So this is the power of delusion. You think you are pursuing happiness, but actually you end up pursuing suffering instead by creating bad karma. Or in the company, you want a promotion in the company, yeah? Or you need more money, so you cheat somebody because you need more money to get that nice Ferrari. If you haven't got a Ferrari, how can you be happy without a Ferrari? Impossible. Yeah? We all know that. So then you make bad karma in the pursuit of that promotion. You make karma in the pursuit of having more money, yeah, of whatever it is. I remember one fascinating example I read about many, many years ago was a very famous investment man from Wall Street. His name was Ivan Bosky or something like that. And I think the movie Wall Street was later on. It was based on his life, and he made some humongous amount of money. And, you know, they have this kind of lists of the wealthiest people in the world, like kind of Forbes magazine or whatever. And he was number 500, yeah? Number 500 in the United States, wealthiest person. And that's, if you're number 500 in the U.S., you are really wealthy, like a billionaire already, if you're number 500. And then he said to his wife, yeah, this is the last time you will see me on the bottom of that list. And then he started cheating, yeah? And then he started insider trading. And before he knew it, he was sitting in jail rather than being, you know, actually going up that list or whatever that he wanted. So that was the desire for social status. He wanted to be higher on that list. It actually instead led to jail. Basically, bad karma leading to bad results. So we do good and bad karma in life, yeah? And sometimes if we are very greedy and very obsessed with the world, we make more bad karma because we forget that there is a bigger picture and we focus only on the short term. If we're not so greedy, then we make less bad karma and perhaps make more good karma. So the balance here will depend on the individual. But it all comes from this drive to create that happiness and because we believe things are more permanent than they actually are. So what happens then? Because we make this good and bad karma, our consciousness is affected by that, yeah? What is good and bad karma? And this is, good and bad karma can be looked upon in many ways. I think one of the things that someone was saying today was that, well, how can we know, you know, this karma business, how can we actually know that we're making good and bad karma? How can we experience that? It is not experiential, it seems to be a matter of faith and confidence, rather than experiential, but we can actually, to some extent, we can actually experience this. And what you will notice is that if you are very sensitive to how you, your actions, you will be able to see that if you do something which is not kind to someone else, you tend to feel bad about it afterwards, yeah? When you think about that act. Or even at the moment you do it, you may actually feel some kind of conscience or something coming up. There's a negative aspect of that. And that is what I would call karma in this very life. Ditteva dhamma karma in the suttas. Ditteva dhamma karma, something like that. In other words, we experience the karma right here in this life through feeling what that action, that intentional action feels like. Or if you do an act of great kindness, yeah, when you're really kind to somebody, you give someone a gift, you speak, you know, in a very kind way to somebody, yeah, and something. Sometimes you get this uplift when you have the sense of generosity towards someone else. When you treat someone with compassion and care, you feel really, this feels really nice. It's a kind of a spiritual uplifting feeling. So if you are careful and you observe your intentions, and you observe the feeling that comes with those intentions, I would argue you can actually experience karma right here in this life. And if you, when you start noticing that, what you start to notice is that the more of these bad actions you do, if one bad act drags you down, you start to, what if I do more of these bad acts? Yeah, it's going to keep going down and down and down and down. It's going to lead to a place of darkness. Yeah, that is how things go. And people who make a lot of bad karma, they often end up as very dark individuals. Their inner world is not bright, it's dark and negative instead. And this is how your consciousness, your mind, is affected by your karma right here and now. Or, if instead you are a person who does more good acts, yeah, and you start to see, well, if one good act does this, what if I do lots of good acts, yeah? And you can see how your mind is affected by the good acts. And you can build it up instead. So the sum total of your actions, the good ones and the bad ones, will then decide your state of your mind, the state of your consciousness. And that can be a fairly dark consciousness, or it can be a fairly bright consciousness, or somewhere in between, depending entirely on the balance between these things. Yeah, our willed activities affect our mind, affect our consciousness in this way. And this is then what actually, that level of consciousness that you are building up in this way, the inner feeling you have, has then a very strong effect on your rebirth in the future. So then leads to the level of consciousness in a future life. The station of consciousness is one of the words used in the Pali Suttas. So this is the outline of how this works. Yeah, this idea of ignorance, not understanding the world in the right way, it makes you act, and those actions, depending on whether they're coming from a wholesome motive or a bad motive, they affect your mind directly. Yeah, this is that kind of main outline here. And I'm going to go through this outline a few times to show you variations on this theme. But let's have a quick break just to digest this a little bit, and then we'll do some Q&A, and then we'll come back to the rest of it. Okay, so are there any comments or questions on what we have been doing in the book Kārunika?
Ajahn, when you were mentioning good and bad karma, were you referring to the punyabhi and apunyabhi sankaras?
Punya and yeah, I suppose.
In that case, could you also talk a little bit about the aninjabhi sankara, which is the third kind, and whether that would lead to the dependent cessation of the whole thing?
Anenja abhisankara. Okay. So anenja is like imperturbable, often translated into English. Abhisankara is just is a creation of imperturbable, basically. It means activities that lead to imperturbable, which basically refers to the very high states of immaterial attainments and the fourth jhana and those kind of things. And it depends whether it leads to cessation or it depends on the circumstance. Yeah, I mean, they're part of the Eightfold Path. So they're part of Samma Samadhi. And if you are a Buddhist, they should lead to cessation because the right view will then inform that after you come out of those states, and then it will actually have that result. But if you are a Hindu, probably not. Yeah, because you get there and think, oh, Brahma, I found Brahma. And if you think you found Brahma, you're not going to go any further because you found the goal of the path, and so you won't go any further. So it just depends. So they're not enough in their own right, but they can be part of the path if you use it rightly. It's like virtue. Yeah, virtue obviously is much, much more preliminary, but that too can be, can lead to cessation, but not necessarily depending on how it is used, etc.
Because the good karmas can keep you in samsara if you keep just doing only good karma and in good places, but there must be some type of a sankara that is helpful for the stopping of avijja. So that's why I was asking that question.
Yeah, but I mean, the thing is that the good karma is it has two things, two aspects. One is the fact that it leads to good results in the future in its own right. The other thing is that it is a contribution to the path to awakening. Yeah. Because it makes you feel happy, makes you feel more, so it's more easy to enter samadhi as a consequence. So good karma is positive in both respects, both if you're going to be reborn, but also as a part of the practice towards awakening. Yeah. So, yeah. It's true, there is a kind of karma eventually that leads to kind of neither dark nor bright karma. But that is kind of the karma that you make as a stream entry, or you start at the point of stream entry. Yeah. So that's kind of, based on that insight. Yeah. Yay.
Hi, Ajahn Bhumali and Venerable Sonia. My name is Michelle. Before you described passive samkara as a conditioned phenomenon, and I didn't fully understand that, could you give a more layman's everyday example of that?
Okay, yeah. Do you want to say something there, Laura?
No.
I brought it in, so I had to kind of I have to sort of explain. Yeah. Well, conditioned phenomenon is just basically everything. Yeah, everything in the world is a conditioned phenomenon. So, just kind of, if you sit here, everything you experience right now, they're all conditioned phenomena. Yeah, you are here, you see this, but this will only last for so long, then it will disappear again. So conditioned means that it is impermanent. That's basically what it means. Because once the condition that gave rise to it disappears, once that condition is gone, it will cease. It will stop to exist. So its existence is dependent on conditions. Yeah. So because it depends on conditions, it will only last for a certain time. Then it will disappear again. So basically, everything in the world is like that. Yeah. When you start to think about your own life, okay, the relationships you have, like your family members, any other relationships, it's all impermanent. Yeah. It will last for a while, but eventually everyone has to die. Eventually, you have to die, I have to die, we all have to die, and then all of those relationships will be gone. And it goes very deeply. And one of the things the Buddha says is that if you do your meditation practice all the way to the end of the path, you realize that everything within you, everything that is part of your personality, everything is a conditioned phenomenon. Yeah, everything is like that. Everything is impermanent. So there's nothing in the world that is not a conditioned phenomenon. So that is, so everything we experience, and that is everything, has come into existence because of our willed actions. And all of those things are conditioned phenomena because they have come into existence because of the willed activities. Those willed activities are impermanent, so the result is also impermanent. Then you start willing something else, you create something else, and it goes round and round like that, carries on and on, always changing, never being stable. And this is one of those fundamental problems with life, is that there's nothing you can really hold on to. Yeah, there's nothing to hold on to in the world. There's nothing you can grasp. As soon as you try to grasp it, you lose the grip, and it kind of goes out, and you lose it. And that is the suffering in life, that everything we try to hold on to, always we always lose the grip on those things. People die, relationships break up, your house burns down. Yeah, it happens here. Some thief steals something that is yours. At the very latest, when you die, everything has to go.
Ajahn, the willed acts that we are talking about are that caused by, due to ignorance or delusion or not knowing the impermanence, etc. So they all, by definition, they have to be unwholesome acts, right? There can't be any wholesome acts?
No, not really, because... I mean, it depends what you mean by wholesome and unwholesome, but usually in the suttas they say acts that are good karma are considered wholesome. Acts that are bad karma are unwholesome. Yeah. So avijja, this is why it is important to make the distinction between avijja and moha. This is why that distinction matters, because it is possible to have amoha, non-delusion, while still having avijja. Avijja is a deeper layer of delusion than moha. So avijja, so if something is done that gives rise to a good outcome, like a happy rebirth, that is what is meant by a wholesome act. It does not mean that it is an act which leads to the end of samsara, but it means wholesome in the sense that it leads to happiness in the future. Preliminary happiness, ordinary happiness, worldly happiness, if you like. That's usually how wholesome is defined.
Okay, thank you.
But there is actions that are even deeper. Yeah, if you talk about the action, I think this was what Venerable Karunika was talking about before, actions that actually lead to the end of samsara. And they are called neither wholesome nor unwholesome. They are acts that lead to the very end of action itself. Yeah? So that's kind of the difference. Yeah. Do all actions that are intentional create karma? No, it is only when it has craving and desire involved with it. Because intention must always be there. Even an arahant has intention, but it does not, it doesn't involve craving. It doesn't involve a creating of a future happiness.
The mindfulness.
Yeah.
Do you have to really distinguish when you're actually having the intention, desire, and craving to understand when karma is going to be created?
Don't keep it more simple. That's too difficult already. Yeah, that's too hard to do for most people to be aware of all your cravings. What really the most important thing is to be aware in the moment whether you are acting from a good heart or not acting from a good bad heart. Not a good heart. That's what matters, yeah? So make sure all your actions, even your thoughts, if you can, come from a good place. If you can do that, you're going to be on the right track. Yeah? Don't try to take it too deeply, because you know, if you want to become an arahant too quickly, you're not going to succeed, yeah? So, yeah.
My question is on Sankara too, okay? Yeah? That is chasing after worldly things. Yeah, you know, we live in a sensual world. Okay, yeah, that we are. I mean, we are sort of support, you know, to understand that chasing after worldly things is not good, okay? That is grasping, okay? On the other hand, the Buddha did also say, you know, the road to enlightenment is the middle way, you know. If you tune the guitar string too much, it will snap. If you leave it too loose, it will, it won't play, yeah. So how do you compare these two?
The middle way is not about a little bit of sensuality compared to no sensuality. No? That's not what it is. The middle way is the middle way between not torturing yourself and sensuality. It's the Eightfold Path is the middle way. So, but forget about that, because you know, you're right in one way. You are right about what you're saying. If people try to walk this path too quickly, it's not going to work. And I would always recommend people to don't worry too much about the craving aspect of the world. Yeah, what most important thing is to overcome the ill will and anger. This is by far the most important thing. Yeah? And if you do want to reduce your desires a little bit, that's good as well. You can always reduce your desires a little bit. Yeah, be more content with life as it is. Not desire a new kind of husband or wife or whatever. Be content with the one you have. Yeah? That's a good start point. Yeah. So reduce it just a little bit, yeah, and then you are already on the right track, yeah. But don't think that all desires are bad. It's not really like that. The Buddha says specifically that the, you know, craving for the sensual things in the world, it is not very blameworthy to have that craving. Whereas anger and ill will is very blameworthy. That is the real problem, because it leads to really bad results. So take it gradually, go slowly. Yeah, don't try to force these things. If you force them, it's not going to work. It should come fairly naturally. Then it's going to work. Yeah.
Can I just add in here? Yeah. See, that's my belief. You know, I might be wrong. Okay? Yeah, it's a bit of desire. I mean, for lay people, it's okay, but you don't overdo it. You know, it's the craving that brings the suffering. You know, you can slowly cut down. You know, if you can.
Good. Yeah. Excellent. Marvelous. I concur. I agree with you, Eddie. Yeah. Okay. Let's take some questions from outside here.
Yeah. Can I do a few?
Please, absolutely. Yeah.
From Zoom Dog. I don't suppose that's not your real name. It's just some internet name. Zoom Dog. Zoom Dog would like to know what the difference is between happiness and sadness. Thank you. Yes. Difference between happiness and sadness. It sounds silly. It sounds like a little bit like a silly question, but I don't think it is actually. It's actually, it can be quite deep, because there's many different levels of happiness. There's also a lot of different levels of sadness. Yeah. And I think some of the lower levels of happiness, and they're sort of the same as some of the levels of sadness. When I was a layperson, I used to like to go to parties, you know, with disco and loud music and dancing and all that sort of stuff. And I thought I was really happy at those parties always, like with my friends and drinking and all that kind of stuff that is long in the past now. But I always thought at those parties I was really happy. Then, when it comes 2 o'clock in the morning, 3 o'clock in the morning, or whatever, and the lights go on, and I have to go home, walk back home, and always, every time walking back home after a party like that, I always felt sad. I felt really sad. And at some point, I realized that happiness during the party and that sadness walking back home, they were not so different. They were really similar. In a sense, the feeling. And it was just the music and the darkness and the lights and sort of that sort of hide a sort of a sadness that it was within me already. Yeah? And so then I started searching for higher sorts of happiness instead of parties and music and all that kind of stuff that I used to do. Started looking more and more for happiness inside of meditation, the happiness of peace, and the happiness of just being content. You all know what I'm talking about. You all meditate, so you know that kind of happiness is very different. That is not doesn't create any sadness. I think that all the sensual happinesses, they always have a sort of an echo of sadness, in a sense. Because you sort of know that they never will be fulfilling. Yeah? Always, there is always new sensual things to discover, or new things to do, new parties to go to, and all those kinds of happiness, they always last only so short. But meditation is like the opposite. Those happiness lasts so long. Yeah. And then the Buddha said, actually, the highest happiness is not meditation. The highest happiness is Nibbana. That's what the Buddha said. Nibbana, the happiness from what we're talking about here, that comes from dependent cessation. So there's grades of happiness. And maybe sometimes happiness and sadness are not so dissimilar, actually. And then I hope that answers Zumba question. And as it, well, they're coming in as we speak, really. Wow. Tyrone asks, how can we practice precepts without being hard upon ourselves? Thank you, he says. He or she, probably he. I would say celebrate your successes and forgive your mistakes. Right? We all make mistakes. Nobody is perfect. So don't try to be perfect with your precepts. The precepts are not fixed rules that if you break them, you are out. No longer a Buddhist, you are doomed. No, it doesn't work like that. As you say, you practice the precept. It's a practice, right? We call it a practice because we know we are not perfect. That's why we practice. No need to practice if you're perfect. So if you make mistakes with your precept, be kind to yourself and, okay, I made a mistake. Forget about it then. You know you made a mistake. Move on from that. But what helps a lot as well, as I said, celebrate your success. Don't forget to contemplate on the things that you've done right with your precepts. Often we keep precepts and we don't reflect upon it, right? We don't bring up the joy that comes from keeping the precepts. And it's very important to do that as well, because the more you reflect upon the joy that comes from keeping precepts, the more likely you are to keep them. So that's short answer to that. Yeah. Celebrate success and forgive your mistakes. So there's a few more.
Yeah, okay, it's really happening here. Okay. Okay, just very briefly. From Pavoy, does Buddhism's impermanence support the idea of constant flux? Yes. One, five aggregates always in the process of change. That's exactly right. Always in the process of change. Correct. Two, the interval between changes is constant. No, that is not true. The interval can vary enormously. You can go into a state of samadhi. It can last for a long time. Things are essentially permanent for that time. And then you come out again afterwards. So the speed, the change will vary, vary enormously depending on what you're doing and what is happening and what you're attending to, etc. From Kanishka in Sri Lanka, can you please elaborate the way to end rebirth? Well, that's what this whole thing is about. Yeah. So we will continue on that for the rest of this course. So just stay tuned and you will figure it out. Number three, from Paul, what is a good practical strategy for recognizing and overcoming craving? Any practical tips? We'll get to this later on as well, when we come especially to the link between Vedana and Tanha, feeling or sensation and craving, then we will talk about how to reduce the craving. Yeah, so it's all coming up later on. Okay, so let's come back to what we're looking at here. So this is the first aspect we just had looked at. We have when things seem to be quite permanent, yeah, but then what happens? Something awakens inside of us. We come to the Buddha Society, we listen to Ajahn Brahm, we don't just listen to the jokes, we listen to some of the content as well. It takes a while to kind of make that transition, but this is Ajahn Brahm's technique. It lures you in with the jokes, and before you know it, you are brainwashed, yeah, and then you are a real Buddhist as a consequence. Yeah.
We haven't made any jokes yet, though.
What? Terrible.
Well, not like...
Okay, you want to tell one? Joke.
About delusion. Okay, I know one. I don't know. a psychiatrist walks in the mental hospital and sees a patient, and that patient, she is dragging a toothbrush on a leash. Yeah. And the psychiatrist says, "Oh, Miss Jones, are you walking your dog again?" He thinks she must be really deluded, right? Uh-huh. And Miss Jones says, "No, no, doctor, this is just a toothbrush on a leash." And the doctor says, "Okay, really good," makes a note. "Oh, this patient is really improving." He walks out, and then Miss Jones said, "Hey, we really got him there, didn't we, Scooter?"
Okay. Well, yeah.
Very loosely related to the topic. You
know, that's really good, actually. Yeah. So, yeah, thank you for that one. That's marvelous. Okay, so let's come back to the what we're talking about before. So, things seem fairly permanent. Yeah, then when we start to get interested in seeing the world more clearly, perhaps we come to the Buddha Society, perhaps we get some other input that makes us see things differently, and as we see things differently, things start to seem less permanent. Yeah, it's when we're kind of moving on this path, so things start to seem less permanent. And just to give you some ideas of how what is happening here is that we're starting to get more right view. We're starting to see the world more in accordance with what it actually is. So what are a couple of ways of doing this? You know, one of the points always is to make this course practical. I had a long list of things I want to talk about, but as always, time is not enough time, so we're going to have to do this fairly clearly. I was sitting with Venerable Sunio in the office at the monastery, and we talked about what we could say, and Venerable Sunio said, "You have to cut down more, there's too many things here." So I said, okay, so I cut a few things out. And this is what we... Some of those ways of kind of making things seem less permanent. Yeah, and I was talking before about how we pursue fantasies in life. We have this idea of what the future will look like, and the Buddha specifically uses the simile of the dream about the sensory objects or the things that we experience in the world. Yeah, we have this dream about the future. We think about what the future is going to look like, yeah? If I get this partner and this house and this job and these friends and so much money or whatever, then, wow, things will be really nice. And they kind of stop at that point, yeah? And the Buddha says it's like a dream. You have this fantasy about things. But then when you wake up from that dream, it's all gone. It's not really there. And this is often what life is like. We pursue all of these things. Most of the time we don't even get them. But even if we get them, they're nowhere near as satisfactory as we thought they would be. This dream about the future, they're built up in our head, completely unrealistic, seeming more happy, seeming more permanent than they actually are. So we need to wake up from that dream straight away. Yeah, I just take myself as an example. When I was, I usually like to use this example, when I was, you know, at university or whatever, a long time ago now, 35 years, something like that. I used to think also about, like everyone else, fantasize about the future. I was going to have this kind of girlfriend, yeah, this kind of job, this kind of house, yeah, and this kind of career. And you have this idea in your mind about where you're going to be. And instead, I ended up like this, yeah. So it's kind of a big gap between the dream and the reality. And this is often how it is. We don't really know what the future is going to be like. The dream is almost always unreal. And then one day you wake up and you realize it's all empty. All that stuff is not actually there. Most of the time we don't get it. It's just a wild fantasy. And even if we do get it, it is nowhere near as satisfying as we think it is. So this is one way of thinking about life. Remember, whenever you fantasize, it's a dream. It's not going to be like that. It's always wrong, always faulty. And then there is another thing that Ajahn Brahm taught me many years ago and kind of at the monastery. And this is the contemplation, the and then what contemplation. Have you ever done the and then what contemplation? It's a really powerful, really nice contemplation. And this is, again, as I mentioned before, we tend to fantasize, we tend to see the result, we tend to see the satisfaction, yeah, of getting the thing that we desire. And our fantasy only goes to that point. Yeah? So to break that fantasy, we have to use the and then what strategy. Yeah? And then what, that's kind of cool strategy. And then what strategy, which goes beyond
the point at which we actually acquire what we are looking for. Yeah, you get into that relationship, and then what? Well, then you go back and you do the dish. You have to do the dishes. Yeah, or you, and then go further than that. Well, maybe it ends up in divorce. Yeah, because it doesn't really work out. Or this person you're with leaves you for another person. At the very latest, one thing that's absolutely sure, one day you're going to die. So if that relationship is really successful and really good, then you're going to die from that person. Yeah. So almost no matter how you look at it, there is a downside once you start to remember the and then what beyond that. And we always forget that. And one of the, I think, I don't know if this is fair on my poor family, but I always like to, you know, I always thought it was interesting to look at my other family members, like my parents, yeah, my brother and my sister, yeah, and I looked at their relationship, and I always asked myself, would I want to live in that kind of relationship? And on the one hand, it's nothing wrong. It's not as if, you know, my family members have terrible relationships or anything like that. Actually, quite good relationships. But would I really, is that what I want? And I looked at them, and you'd see that there's a lot of downsides in these things. There's kind of petty arguments sometimes and negative things. And I think this is true almost of the vast majority of relationships. There are some exceptions, of course, but it's a very common thing here. And I looked at it, and I thought, of course, we tend to be really conceited. Yeah, and I'm no exception to that. So you always think that, actually, if I were to have a relationship, it wouldn't be petty or negative. It would be really good. Yes, yeah? So I would be different. But of course, it isn't like that. The reality is that we tend to be exactly like everyone else. We are no wiser than anyone else. So I always use the idea of looking at my parents, looking at my brother and sister, and saying, well, if I were to get into a relationship, it would be just like them. Do I want that? Actually, no way I want that. Yeah, sorry, brother and sister, if you're listening to this, but, you know, you know, it's really because it's not really fulfilling in the way that we think it is. And this comes, if you use the and then what contemplation, you remember those aspects of relationships. You remember those aspects of getting a new house. You remember those aspects of getting a career boost, yeah, whatever it is, or a salary increase and all of these kind of things. There's always a downside. It is not really satisfactory. Once you get there, you carry on. There's more to be gotten, and there's no end to it. And Ajahn Brahm, I like the way he used to explain this. You know, he said that in a movie, the movie always ends with a kind of the hero riding off into the sunset. Yeah, it's a beautiful scene. Yeah, the hero has kind of, you know, killed. You know, the cowboy has kind of, you know, dealt with all the enemies, and then kind of at the very end, kind of cool fellow, he kind of rides like Clint Eastwood or whatever. Rides off into the sunset, yeah, and kind of some cool music with it, and that's the end of the movie, and then we get all the credits coming down after that. But life isn't like that. What happens after he goes into the sunset? Well, after that, he has to go home, yeah, the hero, goes back to his wife, yeah, and the wife says, okay, the dishes need to be washed, okay, yeah. And Clint Eastwood is not as cool when he's washing the dishes as he is when he's riding off into the sunset, yeah, let's face the facts. But this is what life is like. And these movies that lead you into that delusion of some kind of permanent state, you have achieved something that now is going to last. But actually, it isn't like that. So next time you have a fantasy, ask yourself, the and then what? Yeah, the and then what reflection to break you out of that delusion that actually that thing that you're looking for actually has some real attraction. This is what Ajahn Brahm taught me. Actually, it is a very powerful, I think, very beautiful way of thinking about life because it takes you out of some of these fantasies. It's an aspect of right view, yeah? And as you do this, as you reflect in this way, there's many more reflections you can do. This is basically how to reflect on the worldly things, yeah? And you can bring it further if you like. And as you do that, what happens is that you are less interested in those worldly things because you start to understand how impermanent they are. They don't really last, yeah? The dream, you wake up from the dream, and then what? Things disintegrate afterwards. And as you become less interested in the worldly things, your sankharas, your willed actions change. You start to become more interested in other aspects of life. Yeah, you start to become more interested in things like kindness. Yeah, because you start to understand that to be kind actually leads to a much more profound and deep happiness than all of these worldly things. You start to think in a different way, with more compassion and care, because you understand that it's building up the mind inside instead of chasing after the impermanent worldly things outside. Instead, let's build up the inner happiness. Where does that come from? Comes from kindness, comes from compassion, comes from all of these beautiful qualities that we talk about on the spiritual path. So you change your goal, your willed actions become different. You start to do willed actions that are more in line with the Dhamma, more in line with right conduct, with right action, right view, right speech, and all of these kind of things. And you make those kind of actions instead. And as you, when you do that, when you change, your sankharas change, then you start making less bad karma, and you make more good karma, yeah? Because you do things that lift you up, that make the mind brighter, and you don't do those things that drag you down and make your mind a more dark and sad and negative and grey place. So the balance of good and bad karma changes. Suddenly more good karma, less bad karma. The balance changes. So the sum means that you feel better about yourself. And because you feel better about yourself, your mind consciousness is affected. That's what it means to be affected, yeah? Is that you feel better about yourself. Your mind is brighter and all of these kind of things. So your consciousness is affected by your actions. You feel better inside. You feel like a lighter, happier person than you did before, yeah? You're allowing your mind to soar a little bit, soaring into the air, because you're cutting those strings and ropes that hold it down to the ground. That's the bad karma. You throw out some of the rocks from your little basket in your balloon, yeah? That's the bad karma rocks. And you add helium to the balloon. The helium is the good action. And then you soar up as a consequence. And it is like that, yeah? The bright mind is a mind that soars. It is a mind that is, you feel a sense of uplift. You feel positive. And that uplift is a bit like samadhi that gradually allows you to lift off above the ordinary world. And ultimately that allows you to gain insight and understanding of the ordinary world below, because your mind is soaring in this way. So this is how your consciousness is affected. You change the balance of good and bad karma as you practice this path. Yeah. But ultimately it goes further, because ultimately, eventually, you actually really see that things are impermanent. Yeah, you keep on carrying on and you see things as less impermanent. But one day, you understand the Buddhist idea that everything is impermanent. And this comes through an act of insight, ultimately. Gradually, you kind of move more and more towards impermanence. Eventually, you see it through an act of insight that everything in the world is in this way. So this is about seeing the five aspects of personality deeply, yeah? Seeing the five khandhas as impermanent. This is what this is about, deep insight into the nature of reality. And when you do that, when you see that everything is impermanent, you stop chasing, first of all, after the worldly things. Yeah, you're no longer interested in the things of the world, because you see they're all hollow, they're all impermanent. They don't give any lasting satisfaction. They are pointless in a deep way. Yeah, why run after things that eventually you have to leave behind? Why run after things that when you die is going to have to, you're going to have to let go of it? And you realize that all you are doing by chasing these empty things, these worldly things, is that you're building up the potential for suffering in the future. Because you will have to give it up sooner or later. So you lose your interest in the worldly things. And again, the sankharas move in a different direction. You start to make sankharas that are more to do with meditation sankhara. You will stillness. You will peace. You will anenja, imperturbable. Yeah, anenja abhisankhara. You will all of these things. That is where your willed activities are. Your mind is moving in that direction. Ultimately, when you see that everything is impermanent, you stop chasing after, you don't chase after anything anymore. You don't even chase after meditation, because that too is problematic. That too is ultimately impermanent. And then you actually don't make any willed activities anymore. You stop trying to create the future. You stop trying to create the world. And this is where all sankharas come to an end. Yeah, and when all sankharas come to an end, you realize that one of the main things in life is that happiness is not found in creating. You cannot create the future. Happiness is found in the present moment, yeah, through stillness. That is where happiness is found. And you realize that actually sankharas, by the very nature, are painful. Yeah, doing, trying to create. First of all, you cannot create a happy future. But more than that, the very act of creating, the very act of willing in the present moment is itself painful. So if you want to be truly happy, the only way is to be still in the present moment. You stop doing any kind of sankhara. Sankharas are, not only can they not create the future, but they're actually problematic in the present moment as well. And then you allow yourself, the mind, to move towards the stillness instead. And that is where you start to find satisfaction. And because you are no longer interested in creating a future, you are not making any karma anymore. Yeah, so you're not making any good nor bad karma, nor the anendra abhisankara karma, no karma whatsoever. And when you're not making any karma, it means that you're not seeking for happiness in the future. And when that is the case, it means that your consciousness is not inclining towards anything. The idea of seeking happiness in the future is like your consciousness is inclining towards something. Yeah, if you are looking for happiness in the future, it means that your consciousness, your mind, is inclining towards that. If you think that, for example, that you know, deep samadhi will give me happiness, then your mind is inclining towards deep samadhi. Yeah, and when you, because you are inclining towards deep samadhi, that inclination of the mind will then give rise to rebirth accordingly in the future. But if you're not seeking for any happiness in the future, there's no inclination of consciousness. The consciousness is not looking towards the future. And that, when you're not looking to the future, that means that there is no projecting yourself into the future. Then rebirth must stop right there. Yeah, because consciousness is no longer looking to the future, then that is exactly what stops rebirth. If consciousness is looking to the future, inclining towards that, then rebirth happens as a consequence of that. Non-inclination of the mind towards anything, that is the end of rebirth. So that is one way of thinking about impermanence, yeah, and how not understanding impermanence leads to all the activities. Gradually uncovering the idea of impermanence gradually leads to a change in sankharas towards more good ones, eventually giving up sankharas altogether. All willed activities gone. Yeah, cessation. This is where we come to the cessation idea. So you can see what's going on here. Avidya, first of all, we have more avidya than avidya is declining. As the avidya, the delusion, the ignorance is declining, the willed activities change. Yeah, they have a different direction. As they change, your consciousness is affected. It's like lifted up, becoming more bright. And this is happening gradually, more and more and more. More and more you turn towards more good actions. Your consciousness becomes brighter and brighter and brighter. Until one day, the avidya, the ignorance, is completely eliminated. And when it is completely eliminated, when you see the world fully as impermanent, you have no desire for the future at all anymore, because the future is no longer interesting. You cannot actually get what you want in that future. No inclination of the consciousness, and then rebirth stops as a consequence. Okay, let's. I'm just going to carry on, because we only have a short time to go. If you need to go, whatever, please feel free to do so, because we are taking a bit of liberties by always changing the time. But now I'm going to look at the same thing. I'm going to go through this quite quickly. So I'm going to look at the same thing through the focus on happiness, yeah, or dukkha, suffering and happiness. So because, again, when we start out, if you have avidya, if you are deluded about the world or you have ignorance about the world, it means that you don't understand suffering. Yeah, you don't understand the Four Noble Truths. The first one, which is the noble truth of suffering. And because you don't understand suffering, you don't understand happiness, it means that you think there's so much happiness to be had in the world. Yeah, relationships, yay, happy. Nice big house, yay, happy. More status, yay, happy. Yeah, this is how we tend to think about the world. And then because of this chasing, and because of this, we think that we know where happiness lies. We think that we know that happiness is out there to be had This is a delusion. Yeah? This is our misunderstanding about the world. And because we think we know where happiness lies, and we follow that idea, we then start to chase after those worldly things. Yeah? Very similar to what I was saying before. We start chasing after the happiness, just like we chased after things that we thought were permanent. Now we look at them as happy instead. We chase after these things. Yeah? All of these worldly phenomena, status, sensual objects, sensory objects of the world, relationships, whatever it is, all of that kind of stuff. We're making sankharas again. So this is the sankhara, the creation of the future that we're trying to do. We're trying to create this fantasy that we have. Again, we make good and bad karma, just like before. When someone or something is in the way of our happiness, because this is the only happiness we understand, the worldly happiness, yeah, because that is what we understand, we make, if someone stands in the way of that happiness, then we do make bad karma, because we try to get rid of that person, yeah, or rid of that situation, because it is blocking us from being happy. Yeah? So we do bad karma. Or if it tends to align with our pursuit of happiness, then we make good karma, if these things kind of work together. Yeah? So again, the same idea again. We make good and bad karma in our pursuit of happiness. You can see the problem here. Yeah, if we really take all the worldly things, if that is our idea of happiness, it's very easy to make bad karma. Because if that is the happiness in life, it means that we are willing to do bad things to acquire it. We don't really understand that the bad actions have consequences of their own. Happiness lies in acquiring these delusions or these things in the world. And again, as we do that, our mind and consciousness is affected. Yeah, it becomes brighter or darker depending on the balance of good and bad karma. But then, of course, we start to realize that maybe these things in the world do not give as much happiness as we think they do. And sometimes that happens as you get older. You start to kind of realize that there was a lot of delusion when you were young. But ideally, we understand that before we get too old. And this is what the Buddha is trying to make us understand. So we start to understand, actually, maybe it is not as marvelous as we think it is. Things seem to give less happiness. We start to understand the dukkha, the suffering of existence more, yeah, the problems of things. So one of the ways to do that, of course, before we talked about impermanence, yeah, so that is one way of doing it. Another way is to remember the hollowness very often of that happiness that we seek. Yeah, we think things are going to be very satisfactory in the world. Actually, very often they turn out not to be that satisfactory. Yeah? Just behind achieving something, there's more craving coming up. That hole inside of us that we're trying to fill in, it is still there. Yeah? A lot of seeking for happiness is actually a psychological lack that we have. We're lacking something inside. And we try to fill up that inner lack through external things. Yeah, if I have that relationship, then I will be happy. We're trying to fill up our inner lack through external things in the world. But of course, a psychological lack cannot really be filled up by external things. It's almost, you know, it's obvious really when you think about it. And though it may give you a temporary kind of reprieve from suffering, soon enough you're going to feel that hollowness, that emptiness inside is going to come back. There's no permanent solution in external things. And so as you remember that, the hollowness inside, the sense of emptiness of not really being fulfilled, there's only one way of having that fulfillment, and that is by working directly on the mind, yeah? By building up the inner happiness instead. That is really the way to develop that sense of completeness inside. And gradually as you do that, as you practice this path, especially when you get to the deeper states of meditation, that is where you start to feel a sense of completion and fullness for the first time in your life. You really feel complete. Deep meditation is really almost like finding the meaning of life itself, because you feel fulfilled for the first time. So you're changing again. You start to understand the hollowness. Yeah, and this is kind of the right view here. There's a nice simile of a dog at a butcher shop, and which expresses this quite well. It's found in the suttas. And this is this poor dog, which is kind of waiting outside the butcher. Of course, the butcher is not going to throw any nice meat to the dog. But what it throws like bones smeared with blood. So occasionally the butcher would throw out a worthless bone to the dog, smeared with blood. And kind of the dog licks this bone, and kind of gets the taste of blood. But there's no satisfaction there. There's no fulfillment in just licking the blood on the bone. So the poor dog gets the taste, but the craving remains the same. And then the dog runs off to the next butcher shop, waiting outside, big doggy eyes, please give me something nicer. And then the butcher, of course, being mean, doesn't really throw any nice meat to the dog, throw that another bone smeared with blood. Okay, there you are. And the dog still gets the taste of blood, gets even more craving because the taste of blood feels nice, but no satisfaction. Runs along to the next one. And runs and runs and runs until it dies. It gets reborn. As soon as it gets reborn, it hits the ground running, moves straight away to the butcher shop again, It's terrible, isn't it? It's real dukkha. And it carries on like this. And you can see how utterly unsatisfactory that is. And how much suffering it is. And the Buddha says, this is what sensual pleasures are like. And this is what our world as human beings is like as well. The simile of the butcher shop. There's no real satisfaction there. We keep on running after these bones smeared with blood. Have you had enough bones smeared with blood? Time to move on from those bones. So, again, this is an idea of right view in the world. And then as you see these things more clearly, you stop chasing, you chase less after the worldly things. Again, your sankharas, your willed activities, they change. They move in a different direction. You start to find satisfaction in living the spiritual life instead. In all the basic qualities of kindness and morality, and ultimately in meditation practice. And finally, you find that satisfaction. You actually find it in deep meditation instead. You find all those things that you ever wanted. You find them in deep meditation. You find them by renouncing all the things that you were looking for before. You renounce all that. Kind of weird, you've been really deluded. You renounce everything in the world, and then as you do that, that is where you find satisfaction. So you make less bad karma, you make more good karma, by doing more the right things. And again, your mind and consciousness is affected. You become have a brighter mind, a more happy one, because of more doing more of the right things. And then there comes a point as you practice this path. You understand more and more the suffering nature of things. You understand how everything is problematic because it is all impermanent. And because everything is impermanent, there's nothing to hold on to. Everything must ultimately, anything you hold on to will ultimately cause suffering because you're holding on to what is impermanent. Then once it kind of slips from your grip, then you will suffer as a consequence. So you stop chasing after worldly things completely. Again, the sankharas change. You move towards meditation instead. You move towards samadhi, these things. You stop completely chasing after anything because everything ultimately has the same problem of being impermanent. It will lead to suffering eventually. And again, you find the happiness in the stillness because that is where it is the opposite of sankhara. Sankharas don't work. You stop making any kamma because the stillness is the opposite of making kamma. You're no longer looking for happiness in the future. You know it's not found in the future. It's found in the stillness here and now. And because you're not looking for happiness in the future, consciousness is not inclining towards anything. Seeking for happiness in the future is equivalent to consciousness inclining towards something in the future. When consciousness doesn't incline, when consciousness doesn't have any tendency, any bias towards anything, then that again is where all rebirth stops as a consequence. Okay, very briefly, also the third characteristic. This is a characteristic of non-self. So when you start out, before you come to Buddhism, it feels like we are in control of things. You feel like these are my possessions. I can control my possessions. I can control my life. Yeah, these are my things. So we seem to be in control of things. And because we seem to be in control, it feels like it as well. Yeah, the inner feeling that we can exert ourselves and have an effect on the world. So we feel we have the power to make things happen. So you can see the connection here. On the one hand, we see happiness in the worldly things as one delusion. And on the other hand, we feel that it is in our power to make these things happen. That sense of things being in our power and at the same time happiness lying in that world, having the power to make them happen and seeing the happiness, those two things together make us act. Yeah? So we have this power, and it's another delusion because we have far less power than we think. Yeah. If we really had the power to make things happen in our way, we would never have any suffering. Yeah, the very fact that we suffer means that we haven't got all that much power. It means that there is a problem. We are overestimating our power, far, by far. Things happen according to cause and conditions, and our power to influence them is very limited. So, and the other reason why we will is because our sense of self. And our sense of self, a very important part of that, is the sense of I being the doer. I'm doing things in the world. Yeah. So if you are the doer, you want to exert that sense of self. And you want to, because you feel like you are alive, you feel like that sense of self is satisfied when you exert it. So the fact that we identify with the doing also makes us act, because that actually makes us feel good. And that is another delusion, because it may turn out, as we say in Buddhism, that actually that sense of self is just an delusion. Then again, we chase after worldly things because we have the power and because we enjoy craving. That's part of the problem. We enjoy craving because that craving actually makes us exert our sense of self. So we enjoy the craving. We even identify with the craving. Yeah, it's problematic. If you identify with craving, and craving is the cause of suffering, whoa, you've got a big problem. Yeah, big problem. So then again, you make good and bad karma as before, and that affects your mind consciousness, yeah, depending on the mix of good and bad karma. But then, as you become practicing more the spiritual path, you start to understand that we are far less in control than we actually think we are. The world tends to run according to cause and conditions. You never know when your body is going to get sick. You never know when the people around you may die. Yeah, that's the reality of things. It's a harsh reality, but unless we face up to reality, there's no way we're going to be able to act in a skillful and useful way. So you start to realize that our control of the world is far less than we think it is. And once you start to realize these things, you also start to suffer less when people actually do get ill, when they do die, when things go wrong. Because you realize, actually, it is to be expected. So, all things happen according to causes and conditions, even your inner life. Yeah, even our inner life. We think that if there's anywhere we should be in charge, it is about our inner life. But you know, you can't really control your inner life either. If you could control your inner life, you'd be happy all the time. But sometimes you have feelings you don't like. Sometimes you have a bad negative dream. Yeah, you dream something negative. Or you have thoughts you don't really want to have. I don't want to be angry. Still you get angry, even though you don't want to get angry. You think about all of these things that happen to us internally. We don't want them, but still they happen. How much control do we have? Actually, it turns out, not all that much. So we remember that the path is, these things are causal rather than happening because of our control. This is the right view. And then after a while, again, you see that the willing is inherently painful. Yeah. So actually, control itself is a problem. Controlling is inherently painful. And because controlling is inherently painful, this is the right view. Why do we even bother controlling here? You stop chasing after the worldly things because you see that, yeah, your sankharas are changing again towards more positive things. You make less bad karma, you make more good karma, and then your consciousness mind is affected once more to become more bright and more wholesome. Eventually, you see controlling as suffering. It's a real problem. Yeah. the sense of self is false, and because of that, there is no point in satisfying a false sense of self. Before you identify with craving, because craving actually makes you feel real, it makes you feel alive. But once you see that that sense of self is false, that whole thing falls apart, and you can no longer identify with craving. Yeah, so you kind of leave all of that behind, and you understand actually it is suffering instead. Stop chasing after worldly things. You stop chasing after anything, because the chasing is the problem. Craving, sankharas are actually suffering. Stillness is where the happiness is to be found, not in the doing of things. You stop making kamma, and then you stop seeking for happiness again in the future, and the consciousness does not incline towards anything at all. And then, basically, there is no rebirth because of that. Everything just stops because there's no inclination towards anything in the future. So, there you are. I apologize for going so fast, but this is just the nature of these courses. Tends to have to do things fast towards the end. So that is the summary of the first 2.5 factors. Yeah, the main thing here is the connection between ignorance and all the willed activities, but also how that affects your mind as well, how that affects your consciousness. A little bit too fast. I hope I didn't lose you too much. I hope it made some sense of what I was saying. If you wish, we can stay a few more minutes and take a few more questions. If anyone would like to ask some questions or comments at this point. Thomas, yeah? Maybe if you can use the microphone, Thomas, if you don't mind. We get this.
Hello. Instead of rushing things at the end, this is a 6 weeks course, so could we just extend it to like a 12 weeks course or whatever?
I think for this time we have to stick to the plan, but maybe next time we can make it a 8 week or whatever is required. Maybe open ended. Yes,
Venerable. I just wanted to ask, is there any relevance to the order that you did this in? Because I, in terms of looking at either anatta or suffering first, or anicca first.
Can you repeat?
Is there any significance to the order that you've presented this in? I think you started with impermanence, and then you went to suffering, and then you went to
Well, this is anatta. This is the standard order in the suttas, because usually the initial understanding is that usually if you understand impermanence, that's often the most easy thing to see, because we can see on some level that things are impermanent in the world. It's kind of obvious. People die, things just seem to be, we cannot see it fully, but we can see it at least in part. And then that brings you to suffering, because whatever is impermanent has to be suffering, because if you hold on to, if you're attached to things that are impermanent, how can you not suffer? This is kind of the, so impermanence naturally leads you to understanding suffering. And then those two together, if things that are impermanent and also suffering, by definition, they cannot be a self, because a self is defined specifically. This is where the idea of self is, again, it refers to that definition they had at that time of a self. It's an inherently permanent thing that exists in the world, So that is a natural sequence in the sutta. So I just follow that natural sequence.
But if you were to focus on, say, the out-of-controlness of things, that wouldn't be a terrible thing to, waste your time on. You shouldn't just you better not focus on that. Focus on the uncertainty.
Focus a bit on all three, Because I wouldn't say it's a waste of time at all. So people have different inclinations, So do what you find works for you, What works. So if you feel that the out of control thing is good for you, well, of course you should use it. Yes, Ananda.
Sorry, Ajahn, last one. You used the balloon example. You said, throw away the rocks, the bad karma, and steam up the helium. So that is to. The question is, when it comes to to my mind came the Lonakapala Sutta in 3100, where the Buddha says we can dilute the bad karma. Can the bad karma be completely displaced by good karma? Is that possibility, apart from those really bad karma like killing the mother? And
that is true. I don't take this symbol too literally, because if you do, you're going to be in trouble. I, you're right. You cannot throw out the bad karma. So a little bit of that rock will remain. Yeah? But the rock will get smaller. I think that's the point. Yeah? You reduce the size of the rock through the magic power, Venerable Sunyo's magic power. You reduce the size of the rock. Yeah. And that's really what you do. So that Lona Pala's simile is actually a very important one to understanding how karma works. You reduce the effect of your karma. You cannot eliminate it completely unless you become a stream entry or an arahant, perhaps.
So by stream entry, of course, you can then throw away all those bad karma, some of them.
Some of them anyway, yeah.
Some of them.
Those that ripen in that lower realm, you can throw out, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Yes, please.
Bhante, can you go back one slide to the one less suffering?
Less suffering slide. Oi! Uh-oh, what's happening? Control. Oops, something happened here. It doesn't work very well. Yeah.
The second last one.
Second last one. Not that one.
No, the foolish.
This one? That's happiness.
That one?
No. The second last one?
We already went to the second last one. That was that one there. That's the second last one.
Yeah. Okay.
You want to see all the? You want to see all the factors? Are there? Yeah.
Yes. I just want to go and make the notes. You know.
It's a bit dark.
I feel. My consciousness affected if I don't have that.
It's going to be online, you know. It will all go online.
But I just want to do it tonight. So
do you? Okay.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay, that dedication, good. I like.
No messing around. Okay, great.
Exactly.
Yeah. Anyone else like to say anything? No, you're all exhausted. I'm a bit exhausted myself, actually. My mind is not really here. All that clear, but there is one more question here. Update for Ajahn and Venerable. Everyone online says, thank you. Everyone online, that's a lot of people, right? So we are really lucky. Everyone online says, thank you.
Everyone.
For example, the Dhamma and the answer to the question. Okay. Even those not online say thank you. Okay, that's marvelous. Yeah.
Can we also say thank you for... Thank you for the people doing all the internet and audio stuff. That is really
marvelous.
Well done. Thank you.
Blimmin' marvelous. Okay, so that's all for tonight. So next time we're going to carry on. So it gets more and more practical as we carry on this course. So please come back next time. We'll see you then, and we have more fun together. But for now, let's just pay respect to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha.